Cabinet today has been approving a number of bills for introduction before the Christmas recess. Some of them coming out of quite long-ranging reviews which have been going on, such as the Financial Advisers Bill, which comes out of the work of the Task Force on the Regulation of Financial Intermediaries, and also some of the work of the Review of Financial Products and Providers. So this is the one that establishes the co-regulatory regime for financial advisers with the Securities Commission and industry-based approved professional bodies will work together to create and monitor standards. That's the Andel Zeal Bill, as is the Financial Service Providers Registration and Dispute Resolution Bill, which comes out of the Review of Regulation of Non-Bank Financial Products and Providers. The emissions trading scheme legislation is ready for introduction. It's a good, thick bill, as is the bill enabling territorial authorities to make provision for the supply of affordable housing in their areas with new planning mechanisms. There is an Electricity Industry Reform Act ready. Now, this one is to facilitate investment in generation by electricity lines companies. The policy on that, as indeed for all these bills, has been signalled previously. There's a Customs and Excise Amendment No. 3 bill. Then there's the rewrite of the Real Estate Agents legislation, which Clayton Cosgrove has well signalled. There is a Patents Bill. This is a rewrite of the 1953 Act. There's been a long-running review of that. The legislation to update the Children, Young Persons and Their Families Act 1989 has been tabled today. It also follows a substantial review. The legislation for introducing a resale royalty right for artists is also ready for introduction. That follows the public consultation and consideration of submissions made earlier in the year. We've also agreed policy on an insurance contracts bill. This updates old statutes governing the insurance industry going back to 1908. So this is a modern rewrite of the legislation. Also agreed the policy for an Interest on Money Claims Act. This follows a Law Commission report on the subject. We have a couple of discussion papers ready in the taxation area. One on new rules around taxation of the life insurance business, and the second, a discussion document on reducing tax compliance costs for small and medium-sized enterprises. The Cabinet's also decided on the next stage of the review of the Heavy Vehicles Productivity Project. This is a project that's been looking at the issue of whether vehicles should be able to be larger and carry greater tonnage. So Anne King will be making a statement about that. And we've also agreed the text of the film co-production treaty, which is to be signed with Spain. Coming up this week in the House, it's a week of government business. It's the intention to progress the taxation, annual rates, etc. Bill on its second reading, and then to move on to Electoral Finance Committee stages. Coming up this week, among other things, the Bali Climate Change Conference gets underway with officials initially. There'll be a special session of it for trade ministers over the weekend, and Phil Goff will go up to that sometime Friday, and then David Parker will go to the Environment, Climate Change Ministers segment, main ministerial segment, which will be Wednesday to Friday next week. We're on another round of China FTA negotiations. I spoke to the Chinese Premier about the negotiations when I saw him in Singapore just about 2 weeks ago. We have an official visit here this week with the Samoan head of state, who I'll be looking after this evening. Michael Cullen will be making another announcement about another milestone passed by KiwiSaver, with numbers enrolling in it. And Pete Hodgson has a speech tomorrow where he updates on the government's policies around the economic transformation agenda. Later in the week, we'll be expecting the release of an international report around New Zealand's rankings for adult literacy. On the issue of the stolen medals from the Waiuru Army Museum, which has been obviously a cause of considerable distress nationwide, one point I wanted to make was that last year we passed through Parliament a legislation called the Protected Objects Act. Now, this act enables us to sign up to international conventions which deal with situations like this where cultural property has been stolen and ends up in the markets in other countries. In the past, we haven't been a party to agreements which would have enabled us to have a fair shot at getting such stolen property back. And the most well-known of these cases would be the Motu Nui panels one, where this property was unlawfully stolen from New Zealand, exported from New Zealand, and went all the way through the court system in the United Kingdom to try and get this property back, and we failed. So in the aftermath of the war in Iraq and seeing the huge theft of cultural property there, I got advice from my officials that to enable us in future to be able to reclaim such property if stolen from us, we really needed to apply our mind to ratifying international conventions. So the Protected Objects Act enabled us to ratify the 1970 UNESCO Convention on the means of prohibiting and preventing the illicit import, export and transfer of ownership of cultural property. There are 114 countries which are party to that, and all the parties to it are bound to prevent illicit traffic in cultural objects by establishing proper legal and administrative measures and providing means for the restitution of stolen cultural objects and to cooperate in facilitating the return of such objects. We also ratified, and I deposited the instrument for this in Rome last year, the 1995 UNIDROIT Convention on Stolen or Illegally Exported Cultural Objects, and it is quite prescriptive in requiring certain measures for the return of objects. So I underline this because if in the event these medals turned up offshore in countries which are party to these conventions, we do have legal means to get return here, which we didn't have in the past when cultural property was unlawfully taken out of the country. Needless to say, all the hopes are on an effective police operation stopping the medals moving out of the country and indeed trying to get their return. And I understand the police have been doing a briefing this afternoon about the way they're conducting the operation. Any questions?
Have you had any briefing from the police or any update on what the chances are of getting these back?
I haven't had a briefing from them, no. I've just seen, in essence, the material that they were going to put out at 3:30 today. My understanding is that at that time in the morning, 1 o'clock or so, there's not a lot of vehicles around the main road in Waiuru. So I guess one would have some hope that a vehicle might have been seen, could have been traced. But I don't have any update on that.
How would you describe the heist?
I think it's deeply distressing because we all see those medals as deposited in the museum for the nation to be able to see. The Waiuru Army Museum is a very popular museum. People go to learn about what happened in the past, and obviously one of the features of an army museum is to see these medals which are awarded for extraordinary heroism. So to think that someone is stealing to order and taking away from the public the right to see those medals is extremely distressing.
Is the government giving any consideration to the National Party botch up over the DVD?
Well, it's certainly a botch up when you have to recall all the copies of it. Mind you, how they intend to get back the ones handed out on Windy Street corners, I really couldn't say.
I'm going back to the medals. Has the government given any consideration to putting up a reward for their return?
Well, that hasn't come anywhere near the cabinet. It wouldn't normally, understand, come to us for a decision. It would be more an issue for police, but no, it hasn't been put to us at this point.
Has there been any sort of consideration, or is there any concern that it may have been a political motive?
I've never heard anything like that. My best guess would be that this is a steal to order theft, because these people knew what they were after. They were in and out of the building at the speed of lightning. Staff were down on the premises within 5 minutes, but it was very surgically executed burglary.
Are there any special measures that can be taken to try and catch anyone trying to take them out of the country, or is it just impossible?
It's a little like looking for a needle in a haystack when you're looking for medals which could be in somebody's luggage. You can't physically search the luggage of everybody who's departing New Zealand. And even if you did, what are you to do? Body search everybody who's leaving New Zealand. If someone is determined to leave with such medals, it would be a sheer chance that you found them. But as I say, it would be very difficult to put them on the market anywhere. It's not unknown for property of this kind to be stolen to order for very wealthy recluses who then never show the medals again.
But it's the assumption that they're going overseas. I mean, you've mentioned that.
It will be difficult for them to be sold overseas. It's not to say they wouldn't be taken overseas, but we now have the measures under international law which we're party to, where we can seek return with reasonable confidence we would get it, which wasn't the case with the Motunui panels, which we fought right through the British court system but could not get back.
Is there any sort of estimate on what they might be worth if they did find a supplier overseas, a recluse?
We're talking millions of pounds. I think there's a figure in the public arena about the price that was paid by a trust in the United Kingdom to purchase the two Upham medals and then have them gifted to the Imperial War Museum, which gifted them on permanent loan to New Zealand. So we're talking many millions of dollars here.
The House is due to rise next week. Are you confident that the Electoral Finance Bill can be passed by then?
Well, the House can go right through till Christmas if it needs to. But the Electoral Finance Bill is obviously on the agenda. There's also a list of first readings which are possible at this time. Well, Annett King's been continuing to work on issues, so there will be a further supplementary order paper.
What have you said to Trevor Mallard about his comments on Aaron Lee in Parliament last week?
Well, I haven't really had the occasion to speak to him about that. I've obviously had a look at the Hansard. I think the best thing at this point is to wait and see what the outcome of the later state services look at the Ministry for the Environment is.
What did you make of the demonstration against the Electoral Finance Bill in Auckland? It was twice the number of the original one.
Probably relates to the fact that Mr. Boscawen apparently spent $120,000 to get people out, including, I understand, automated phone messages around the Auckland area.
So whether
5,000 is a good return for that investment is for others to judge.
So you're saying there's no correlation between the amount of money he spent and the number of people he actually got out to support?
Well, how much per head is it?
Do you think it's his money or something else?
I'm sorry?
Do you think it's his money or something?
Well, hard to know.
What do you think of the Greens' idea of
Well, citizens' assemblies have been tried in the United Kingdom. They can work quite well. I remember sponsoring a talk here in Parliament going back to around 98-99 from one of the UK think tanks which had worked on citizens' jury issues. So, in principle, such juries can be a good idea.
So you'd be receptive to that idea?
Well, you know, it's one of many ideas.
Well, what say it's actually put forward as an SOP?
Well, I don't think we're looking to specify means of reviewing those issues in the law itself. But, of course, the government signaled months ago that there were issues which would go to independent review.
Mr. Burton talked about an independent review back in July. Mm. Is that still a valid?
Yes, it is.
Just returning to National's DVD for a minute, do you think that it damages John Key's credibility at all that he's put out a DVD which focuses solely on him and yet it actually is illegal?
Well, look, I haven't seen it. Everything I've read about it suggests that it's vacuous in every respect, and particularly with the music out of it, even more vacuous.
Just on Erin Lee, she says that Heather Simpson was quite actively involved in correcting work when she was at the Environment Ministry. Are you aware of what she was doing there?
And I haven't the slightest idea what she's talking about, sorry.
Are you still intending to legislate to stop power companies generating new... making new fossil fuel generation?
We are looking at legislation around the issue of fossil fuel generation, yes.
Will it be
in
separate
legislation? No, we've got two bills relevant to this coming up. One of two electricity related bills. One is the emissions trading scheme, and my understanding is the thermal generation issue is covered in that. The other bill I mentioned today is the one which facilitates investment in generation by lines companies.
So will it actually have a ban in it or a capacity to ban it?
Well, you have to wait and see the form of it, but the policy is well set out in the bill.
I think you were away when the Electoral Commission Chief Executive suggested that a lot of the new electoral law will be determined by case law. Do you think that's an ideal way to have...
I understand that she's been in further discussion with the Minister of Justice, and the Minister of Justice is, as I said, working on a further SOP, which will clarify the matters that have been raised.
Just on Trevor Mallard in court today, this morning on television it looked like you were expressing a little bit of concern about private prosecutions. Do you think there needs to be a law change?
I understand the Law Commission looked at the issue a number of years ago, but it proved to be quite complex, so there's nothing under consideration, nothing planned. But the point I was making was that if we're entering a more litigious age, then anybody in public life, from media figure to fashion designer to politician, high-profile person, is vulnerable to such action.
Do you think the one against Mr. Mallard is frivolous?
I don't wish to make any comment on the particular case because it's before the court as we speak.
On the China trade negotiations, are you hopeful that this week's talks will resolve the sort of final sticking points of the deal?
There's no doubt that the talks are very highly advanced, but we're not there yet. But nor are we at the outer edge of the two-year envelope which was set for the negotiations. So, obviously, we're hoping to make good progress this week.
They weren't expected to meet again until next year, so what pushed forward the talks?
Oh, no, I think it was expected that we'd try and get together before the end of the year. It would have been ideal to have been talking somewhere around early October, but, of course, that ran into the major holiday week in China and also the... big Congress of the Communist Party where various people change office, including office relevant to the negotiation of these agreements. So that's what's taken a little time to get the negotiations back together. But no, December in the circumstances is optimal for this round.
Do you intend to meet Mr. Rudd before your regular annual meeting next year? And if so, did you think of going to Bali to have that meeting?
I didn't think of going to Bali, no, because generally it's not pitched at being a head of government meeting. It's pitched at ministers for the environment, climate change issues, like Mr. Parker. But I fully understand where Mr. Rudd is going, because this is a very significant change of policy for Australia. And he is going with his team, which I understand involves a number of other ministers, to make the point that Australia is on board with Kyoto, and on board with binding commitments. But I'm not intending to go there. If the opportunity crops up to see him informally before the formal talks are scheduled, yes, I'll take it.
What do you make of the shift in Australia's position in terms of the worldwide threat? I mean, is it the US isolated? Is it a positive advance for the Kyoto-friendly countries?
Well, it's regarded as highly significant because there were two Schedule 1, Annex 1 countries who had not ratified. One was Australia, the other was the United States. Australia coming on board reduces that to one. Now, within the US itself, of course, there are quite a lot of states who are taking their own action and developing emissions trading schemes and trying to work on a state level to get emissions down. I guess the issue will be whether this becomes a significant issue in the US presidential campaign. At this point, it isn't. In the Australian election campaign, it became a significant issue.
Do you think it's putting more pressure on the US? Do they just sail on this regardless of world opinion?
Well, the US is big enough, I think, not to feel that pressure in that sense as a country. In the end, it will be a political decision whether they accept binding commitments. I'm sure that they will want to continue to be in a position to influence the arrangements going forward post-2012, that the issue remains. Will they, like other Annex 1 countries, eventually accept binding commitments?
So does this mean that climate change is likely to be fairly high on the list of talks when you have your leaders meeting next year?
Well, I would think so. I mean, it's been on the agenda with the previous government as well, particularly in the lead-up to the APEC summit, when I went across to Sydney with the trade mission in June and spent time with Mr. Howard then. We spent quite a lot of time around what could be achieved in the APEC leaders' declaration and also talking about the emissions trading scheme which his own government had been developing, because they were keen to see if they could have theirs compatible with ours and vice versa. So we have been working on that. And I'm sure that work that was being done under the Liberal National Party government in Australia will certainly inform whatever the new ALP government wants to do by way of emissions trading. In Australia as well, at the state level, there's also been a lot of work around these emissions trading issues.
Can I ask you about Russell Fairbrother's selection and over Stuart Nash, and where does that
sit in your rejuvenation plan? Well, Mr. Fairbrother has risen to the challenge and won a selection fair and square, and I congratulate him on that. He's very clear that he is not seeking a place on the Labor Party list. He is giving all his attention to the Napier seat. Mr. Nash will seek a position on the list, and he is a very credible candidate and one who the Labor Party will certainly be seeing a lot more of.
Could we have an irony where Mr. Nash is high enough up the list that he gets back to Parliament and Mr. Fairbrother doesn't?
You never know. You never know how Mr. Fairbrother's campaign is going to go and what has traditionally been a Labor seat.
What do you think of Winston Peters standing in Tauranga?
Has he formally announced that, or is it just speculation?
I think it might be informed speculation.
Would you welcome it?
I really have no opinion to offer, except to say that it appears the National Party will be looking for a new candidate, so I guess that creates openings all round.
Do you think the survival of New Zealand First via that seat is a boon for National or Labour more?
I don't really have any comment. Obviously, we have had a productive and good relationship with Winston Peters and New Zealand First in this term in Parliament, and it's worked well for us. I hope it's worked well for them.
Just one more question on candidates. What about John Tamaki, who's standing for National? Have you got any comment to make there?
Good luck.
The John Tamaki National.
I think I did. Oh yeah, look.